Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today, I'm talking to Rodney Jones about his book, Health and Risk Communication, An Applied Linguistic Perspective, which explores some of the many ways in which the discourses around health relate to people's behavior, and how we might study these as a route towards improving communication in practical situations. In this interview, we discuss the conflict that can arise between medical advice and social pressures, and what medical practitioners and scientists can do to get their message across. And we explore the ways in which new technology changes the discourse around health and risk, both by creating new communities that discuss health and by creating entirely new representations that can be talked about. I'm delighted to welcome Rodney Jones to talk about his book, Health and Risk Communication, in which he takes an applied linguistic perspective in examining the relationship between our discourses and our actions in the area of health. Rodney, how did you come to write this book?
Well, my interest in health communication goes back to when I was working on my PhD dissertation. The subject of my PhD dissertation was health communication in China. And at that time, I was looking at the discourse around HIV and AIDS in China in the late 90s. And I became interested, first of all, in the kinds of linguistic structures and generic forms that health communication messages took, particularly health communication pamphlets, safe sex pamphlets, essentially, instructing people on how to conduct themselves to avoid infection with HIV. But then I began talking to people in various vulnerable groups who were interacting with these pamphlets and trying to understand how they understood what they were being told and how they actually used the pamphlets themselves as textual objects and the information in the pamphlets to negotiate sexual contact with various people. So I looked at gay men, I looked at sex workers, I looked at a number of different kinds of populations, and I started to realize that one of the biggest challenges, I think, for health communication, but also one of the biggest challenges for applied linguistics, is understanding what exactly is this relationship between discourse and action. That is, what is the relationship between what's written down in these pamphlets or what people say to each other and what they actually end up doing? I mean, in this case, what they actually end up doing in a very sort of physical way. But it can be extended to other kinds of contexts in health communication. So what is the relationship between what a doctor says to a patient and the way that verbal interaction transpires and whether or not the patient, for example, takes the medicine in the way they're expected to take it or undergoes the treatment or changes or does not change their behavior.
You mentioned there and in the subtitle of the book that you're adopting an applied linguistic perspective to these issues, but I guess applied linguistics can mean several things. What does it mean to you in this context?
Basically, applied linguistics to me means using principles from linguistic analysis to try to solve real-world problems. So I view applied linguistics in a rather broad way. In the history of applied linguistics, the main real-world problem that we've been most concerned with is how people learn language. But I think more recently, applied linguists have been concerned with other issues of linguistic communication, such as professional communication, such as issues around legal discourse, such as forensic linguistics, such as issues around mobility and immigration and these sorts of things. And I think it is very important for applied linguists to try to, so to speak, widen the circumference of their interests, because I think that quite a lot of problems in the real world have a lot to do with the way people use our language and understand how other people are using language. And I think that applied linguistics in general has quite a lot to offer to the world beyond the teaching of language.
Absolutely, yes. And in the book, you raise many areas in which there's, if you like, some room for a linguistic contribution. And you begin by discussing how we define health and risk, but a crucial point here that recurs throughout is the fact that the way people relate to the concept of health seems to be undergoing particularly radical changes with respect to current technological advances. I guess this makes it a particularly exciting time to be trying to bring this new perspective to some of these issues.
I think it's an exciting time to be working in the area of health and healthcare. I think it's also an exciting time to be working in the area of applied linguistics and language studies, because all sorts of things are changing about the way we communicate with one another, mostly having to do with the kinds of new technologies that we're using. And so, you know, the mobile internet, mobile technologies, the kinds of social networking sites and the kinds of interactions around there, the opportunities that people have to share information, to compile information, to analyze information, to participate in the creation of big data sets, and to use various kinds of tools to analyze that data. It's really quite exciting. So in the book, I did talk about a number of examples. For example, I talked about the website Patients Like Me, which is a sort of online health social network where people with different conditions get together and share details about their medical tests, about their medication, about their symptoms, and that sort of thing in a very, very detailed way. Now, people have said to me, well, you know, people have always done that. There have always been these sort of support groups, and then there were sort of online support groups. But what's different about this? Well, what's different about it is that people are not just sharing anecdotes. They're not just sharing general information. They're actually uploading the details of their medical histories, their medical records, to these kind of public databases, and then interacting with other people about their data. And that's a really extraordinary development if you think about it. And there are all sorts of questions that come up with this sort of thing. So questions of privacy, questions of how non-medical experts interact and interpret medical data, questions about how patients interact with each other and work together to create knowledge, and even questions about kind of activism. I mean, what happens when patients get together and start questioning some of the ways things are done in the medical profession? And so it's a very, very complicated kind of situation. And it's really something that it's going to create a huge challenge for the medical community. It's going to create a huge challenge for doctors and other healthcare workers. And I think this is where applied linguists can really help out a lot. Because, I mean, there are a number of ways you can respond to this if you're a doctor. One way to respond is denial. Say, well, you know, it's not happening, and even if it is happening, I don't want my patients to go on the internet and find anything out about their condition, because that just interferes with them listening to what I'm telling them to do. But that kind of attitude is simply not going to work. You can't escape the fact that people are interacting with sophisticated medical knowledge and trying to apply that to their own health. And so doctors really need to develop new ways of communicating with their patients about this. Now, the kind of move towards patient expertise, towards, you know, medical encounters that involve the patient as a kind of partner in healthcare. Well, this sort of idea has been developing for many, many years now. But I think these new technologies really bring this to a new level. And so this is I think an area where applied linguists can assist the medical community in understanding what are the implications. How do these new forms of knowledge and knowledge building impact on the strategies that we use to communicate with our patients?
Absolutely, yes. I suppose there is in some sense these two strands of recent development that are pertinent. The question of how we interact, as in social networks, online support groups, and so on. But you have a question of what we talk about, the idea that we can have this much more detailed, much more sophisticated information uploaded, as you say, or things like genetic tests that you talk about, or the contents of scans that in some sense, you know, must seem to want to reduce us to a data file.
Yes.
I guess a question I have sort of analytically is do you think the analysis of these as texts and talking about this in terms of discourse processes is a particularly good sidelight on these kinds of things?
I think that applied linguistics has quite a lot to offer in looking at these kinds of interactions. I'm not sure I would necessarily characterize it as looking at them as texts, but looking at them as sometimes as texts, as sometimes as interactions. I mean, the beauty of applied linguistics is that it's not one thing. That applied linguistics is a kind of a toolkit that allows us to look at linguistic data, to look at verbal behavior, or maybe we can say semiotic behavior, in lots of different kinds of ways. We can appropriate the tools of conversation analysis and look at the kind of sequentiality of interactions. We can appropriate ideas from linguistic anthropology and look at the context in which these interactions are occurring. We can appropriate tools from interactional sociolinguistics and look at things like, you know, pauses. And we can even appropriate tools from, you know, more recent developments in applied linguistics, like multimodal discourse analysis. And we can try to understand the way nonverbal cues and graphics and things like this interact with language. And so I think that the great thing about applied linguistics is that it allows us to look at these kinds of interactions in not only new ways, in ways that generally are not part of traditional communication studies, and also in a lot of different kinds of ways. That is, there's a real flexibility there. There is a long tradition of health communication studies. It's sort of in the field of sociology and the field of communication studies. And of course, they've made lots of important contributions. But I think that applied linguistics provides a very, very different kind of perspective, a perspective that looks much more at the role of language and looks at the role of language in a much more sophisticated way. Maybe I can give you an example from, it's actually something I mentioned in the book, having to do with electronic health records. And so now lots of doctors are using electronic health records. And so when the patient comes in, they have the electronic health record on their computer, and they refer to the patient's electronic health record as they're examining the patient or as they're conducting the consultation with their patient. And there has been quite a lot of work done in this in the field of health communication from a kind of communication studies point of view. And they've looked at things like how the presence of the computer screen affects the eye contact between the patient and the doctor and that sort of thing. But the way they look at it is generally in this very kind of quantitative way, where they can say, well, you know, the time that the doctor looked at the patient was reduced by 50% or something like that, and sort of automatically assuming that that's a negative thing, right? Now, an applied linguist or a discourse analyst, somebody who is schooled in conversation analysis and interactional sociolinguistics, could look at that same situation and instead of asking these kind of very, very broad, blunt questions, do a much closer analysis of what exactly is going on. So, for example, if the doctor is looking at the computer, does that necessarily mean that he or she is ignoring the patient? Is that necessarily a bad thing? Do doctors sometimes use the computer screen in a strategic way? For example, when they see that the patient might need some more time to think about an issue that's been raised, and to give them time to think, they might turn to the computer screen to create that kind of space. So what applied linguists can do is to look at these interactions in a much finer way, in a much more delicate way, a way that goes beyond things like the content of what people are talking about, and also goes beyond the kind of quantification of verbal behavior. And so when you get to training people in medical communication, you can go beyond this kind of skills-based approach, which tells trainee doctors things like, oh, well, try to make eye contact with your patient, or try to smile, or try to act empathetic, and can actually get people to think in a much more sophisticated way about what it means to communicate and whether or not looking at the person more is appropriate in this particular situation, or whether or not smiling and being empathetic is appropriate at this particular moment.
Indeed, yes. And presumably, as the new technologies emerge, these, if you like, new discursive practices arise that in which people in some sense negotiate how they can make best use of these in communication. And I guess this is something that you can trace through these techniques.
Absolutely. And you know, what's particularly exciting is the kind of insights that discourse analysis and applied linguistics can bring to computer-mediated communication. And you know, it's not going to be too far into the future where most of the interactions between doctors and patients are not face-to-face interactions. They're interactions that will be mediated through some kind of technology. The Xbox One that just came out has a sensor in it that's sensitive enough to measure your pulse, to measure your temperature, to measure your blood pressure. And so it could be in the future that you'll be interacting with your doctor, not in his in his consultation room, but through your video game console. And so this creates all sorts of challenges for people, all sorts of interesting new social norms around doctor-patient communication are going to have to develop. And I think this is the place where applied linguistics can make a great contribution.
Yeah, another technology you discussed, which I guess has some of the same features, is the genetic testing. In chapter 4, you talk about the way in which the people using these technologies, the people, if you like, administering or counseling patients on genetic tests, relate to that information. And I guess that's another kind of process that's in some sense running behind technology, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the technology for genetic testing has developed so quickly in the last 10 years. I mean, 10 years ago, it would cost thousands of dollars to get your genome sequenced. Now it costs about $1,000 to have an entire human genome sequenced, and it costs in one of these genetic testing services like 23andMe, it costs $99 to have almost a million single nucleotide polymorphisms analyzed, which can give you quite a lot of information about things like disease risk. Now, as soon as you start talking about disease risk, it becomes very problematic. Because even in the best of conditions, even when you have professional doctors or genetic counselors talking to people about risk, there's a lot of room for misunderstanding, for anxiety. Even the doctor or the genetic counselor may not know exactly what are the implications of this, you know, increase or decrease risk for a particular kind of medical condition. And so the fact that it has become much cheaper means that it's also become much more available. I wouldn't be surprised if sometime close into the future that having a full genome sequence will be something that pretty much everybody does. Everybody will have this information as part of their kind of standard medical record. Now, what will that mean? Well, it'll mean all sorts of things. It'll mean figuring out how to talk about these things, which are essentially probabilities, in a way that's useful, in a way that's not counterproductive. And you can easily imagine there are ways that this can be quite counterproductive. For example, you may have one of these tests and find out that you have a gene that predisposes you to Alzheimer's disease, for which there is no cure and for which there is no real preventative measure that you can take. How does a person respond to that? And how does somebody counseling that person help them to work through that information in a useful way? But even more interesting to me is the fact that a lot of people now are having access to this kind of information without the benefit of professional guidance, without a genetic counselor, without a doctor to kind of talk them through it. And rather than the professional, what they have are these kinds of online communities where they interact with other customers of these testing services and try to collaboratively make sense of their genetic tests. And as a matter of fact, I've just gotten a grant from the Hong Kong government to look at how customers of genetic testing services work together on these sort of online forums and social networking groups to develop a kind of lay expertise around this kind of material.
It obviously creates some interesting problems, although you don't emphasize this angle in the book, I think, but there's a lot of research suggesting that people are generally not very good at assessing information that's presented probabilistically about risk, that people succumb to various fallacies like base rate neglect and so on. Is that a problem that you see in this?
A central problem, the problem of how we talk about risk. And I do touch on this a little bit early in the book, where I talk about different forms of contextualization and different ways, for example, that things are quantified, that we use quantification as a way of discussing health and risk. And I mean, part of it is that many people don't have the background in statistics, probability, to understand that sort of thing. But that's not really the main thing. The main thing is that this kind of language is and has been manipulated by various players. And so in any kind of medical situation, you have all sorts of people who are communicating. You have the doctor communicating with the patient, but you also have all of that background noise. You have pharmaceutical companies, you have relatives, you have all sorts of people who are contributing to any given person's conversation about health and risk. And one of the main ways that pharmaceutical companies talk about their drugs, particularly in places like America and New Zealand, where there actually is direct-to-consumer advertising about drugs, is by presenting the statistics from clinical trials in ways that are very easy for patients to misunderstand, or very, very easy for patients to develop the wrong idea about. And so, medical communication is a very, very complicated thing. And I think one of the main points I try to make in the book is that I feel that at least the work done in applied linguistics so far has focused so much on the doctor-patient interaction and sort of what goes on there. And what I argue for in the book is what I call opening the circumference and realizing that actually that doctor-patient interaction is only a small piece of the health communication that any given person is involved in, that there are all sorts of other voices that contribute to their understanding and their decision-making about health. So conversations with their family members, conversations with their sexual partners, conversations with their yoga teachers or gym instructors or clerks at health food stores, all sorts of media, magazine articles, television documentaries, and of course we've mentioned all of the interaction that goes on the internet and all the texts about health and medicine that come out on the internet. So trying to understand, you know, not just how a doctor explains risk to a patient and how the patient understands it, but understanding how this conversation is actually contextualized in a whole kind of world of discourse, and how that world of discourse affects not only, you know, how the patient understands risk, but what exactly is the patient able to do about risk in the end of the day. So, I mean, it's one thing for the patient to come away from such interactions with an understanding of what they're at risk for or what kind of behavior they should engage in, but how easy will it be for them to actually carry out that behavior? And, I mean, very often that also depends on communication. I'll give you an example. When I was looking at HIV, the communication between HIV patients and their doctors here in Hong Kong, we found that the patients often had a really hard time taking their medicine on time. And as you may know, taking HIV medication, at least at that time in the late 90s, taking HIV medication at the right time, in the right sequence and this sort of thing was very, very important. And the doctors kind of assumed that it was because it was an understanding problem. It was that they didn't understand how to take it, or they didn't understand how important it was to take it on time and that sort of thing. And so they tried to solve the problem by simply giving the patients more information. But after we talked to the patients, we came to understand that there were actual barriers, communication barriers in their lives outside of the clinic that had an important bearing on you know, very practical things like taking medicine. For example, eating with your family is a very, very important part of Chinese culture. It's a very important kind of communicative act to have dinner with your family. And if during your dinner with your family, you find that you have to suddenly take some medicine or even absent yourself from the situation to take some medicine, this creates dilemmas, communicative dilemmas for the patient. And so even something, you know, so seemingly unrelated as, you know, sort of having a meal with your family can affect quite a lot the ability for people to engage in the kind of actions that they need to benefit their health.
Yep, and this is the theme of the chapter Beyond the Clinic, sort of taking a message from that is that what may seem irrational in some sense or seem to result from people not having understood the information that's being given them about health and risk can actually be clearly logically motivated if you look at it from a slightly different perspective. Do you feel that's something that's underappreciated by, for instance, policymakers on health?
Well, I think it is, and I think that you know, one of the great insights of linguistics is that everything is meaningful. Right? There is no such thing as a meaningless utterance. That is, every utterance has some kind of purpose, some kind of meaning. It may not be to express information. It may be some kind of phatic meaning. It may have to do with working on the relationship. But every single utterance has some kind of meaning that is analyzable. And so if you approach language and communication that way, then when you look at people's health-related behavior, you already have the kind of analytical equipment to see that although this does not make sense from the point of view, from sort of a medical point of view, that it may actually make sense from a communicative point of view. That although this person is putting themselves in danger and may actually know that they're putting themselves in danger by engaging in a certain kind of activity, it might be that engaging in that kind of activity is playing a very, very important role in their lives, in their relationships, in their place in the community in which they live. It may be fulfilling some kind of very important communicative purpose or purpose of signaling some kind of identity or some kind of commitment or some kind of membership in a community, that sort of thing. And so if you start to look at people's behavior in that way, their behavior starts to make sense. It starts to take on an internal logic. Now, to say that somebody's behavior is logical doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't try to help them change it. That's a mistake that some people might make when they hear me saying, okay, well, you know, they're taking drugs and they have a reason for doing it, or they're not using condoms and they have a reason for doing it. But by saying they have a reason for doing it doesn't mean that we shouldn't help them to change that behavior. It just means that the way we can help them to change that behavior becomes much more workable. It becomes much more sophisticated, that we can go beyond simply giving them information, that we can go beyond simply giving them prescriptions and telling them what to do. And we can go beyond simply throwing up our hands and saying, well, they're just illogical or they're just self-destructive when they don't listen to us, right? It allows us to try to design interventions that may not actually address the behavior, but may actually address some kind of communicative circumstances within the community that make that behavior either more or less possible.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying seems to make a lot of sense to me. In that light, I'd like to, if I may, turn back briefly to chapter 3, which in which you talk about competing ways of contextualizing reality and give a particular example of the concerns about the side effects of the MMR vaccine. Because I think it makes some pretty interesting points there. What I wondered, really, do you find it difficult to remain, so to speak, an impartial observer of these processes of contextualization?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's really necessary to be an impartial observer, in that I don't think that it's necessary for me to not have a position on whether vaccinations cause autism. I mean, I do have a position on that, and I don't believe that these vaccinations cause autism, and I think that's what the research has shown. At the same time, that doesn't mean that I can't understand why people think that they do, and that I can't understand the effectiveness of the kinds of arguments that proponents of that position make. And as I say, understand the kind of way that process of communicating about health and understanding one's health within one's community fits into people's lives. And so for me, that's a very, very important thing. I would like to change people's minds, you know, the minds of people who don't want to have their children vaccinated. I'd like to change their minds, but the way to change their minds is not just to simply say to them, you're wrong. The way to change their minds is really to understand why they believe this, you know, and what are the kinds of discursive structures and the discursive processes and the social processes that have led up to so many people, and it's actually quite a lot of people taking these kinds of positions.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, I think you make the assumption of goodwill, so to speak, on the part of the people whose opinions you disagree with here, which I get the impression from your chapter is something you feel the scientists have, in some sense, failed to do in certain cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to... I don't want to denigrate scientists or doctors. I have great respect for scientists, the scientific community, and the medical community. I think that the point I'm trying to make is that that really scientists, doctors, and lay people of various kinds speak different discourses. And a lot of the difficulties that they have in communicating, or the difficulties they have in understanding why people do the things that they do, is really a kind of a problem of intercultural communication, kind of a problem of it's not so much that, you know, I'm right or you're wrong. It's that people are involved in different discourses. And when I say different discourses, it's sort of like, yeah, they're speaking different languages. But, you know, a discourse is, as you know, a much bigger thing than that. A discourse is a kind of ideological position, a kind of way of being in the world, a kind of identity within a community. And it's very, very difficult to bridge these kinds of discourses. So I don't blame the doctors, and I don't blame the patients. I don't blame anyone. I just think that applied linguists can play a role in helping to bridge the gap a little bit, helping different parties to see that, you know, it's not that people are stupid. You know, I think that people are very intelligent in general about the decisions that they make about their health. And people spend a lot of time and a lot of energy thinking about the decisions that they make about their health. And sometimes the decisions they make are not the decisions that their doctors want them to make, or that science might say would be the sort of most sensible decision to make. But there are almost always reasons for that. And so understanding these reasons is very important. And, you know, giving doctors and scientists ways of more effectively communicating, you know, what they're finding out is so important. And most of my colleagues who are scientists, I think, would agree with me. And I've spoken to them at length about this. I mean, scientists are very, very important parts of our community, and science inside of a laboratory is not, you know, doesn't do anybody any good. Science, in the end of the day, is public policy and personal behavior. And so the way these scientists communicate will have a direct impact on whether or not what they're saying has an effect on public policy. So can they communicate with politicians, for example? Can they get funding for what they need? Can they convince politicians to adopt certain kinds of policies? I mean, we see this so clearly in things like climate change. And, you know, I think that the politicians have a long way to go when it comes to climate change, but I think scientists have a long way to go as well in being effective in communicating to people about that.
You also discuss another case of, if you like, intercultural communication back in the medical domain, when you talk about doctor-patient interactions, but in particular you talk about the role of narratives in diagnosis. And there seems to be quite a lively debate there about how doctors can best obtain the relevant information from their patients, which will enable them to make the right diagnostic decisions. Do you take a particular position on this?
Well, tend to take very sort of strong positions one way or another about linguistic forms. So I think in this chapter I talk about diagnosis and narrative as two kinds of, I wouldn't say polar opposites, but two alternative ways of contextualizing the body. I think within the medical community, there's this, particularly in the field of narrative medicine, you know, there is this idea that, oh, well, you know, narratives are much better than simply, you know, getting people to ask questions. And I'm not prepared to say that. What I am prepared to say is that there are lots of different ways of contextualizing the body. And so lots of different ways for doctors to find out what's going on in a patient's body, and a lot of different ways for a patient to express and experience what's going on in their own body. And they have different affordances and constraints. And so it's not a matter of good or bad, it's a matter of affordances and constraints. And now with new technologies, so for example, apps on your iPhone that allow you to keep track of, you know, how much you've eaten and how much you've slept and generate little graphs about, you know, how quickly you're jogging and this sort of thing. This is yet another way of contextualizing the body, and this is going to create even more challenges for people. So I would never want to say, and I mean I think this is where I think my work and the work of most applied linguists differs from the work of a lot of people in sort of more traditional health communication, is that I would never want to be a proponent of a prescriptive kind of recipe approach to communication. I wouldn't want to say, oh, you always must let your patient tell their story, sort of things. In some situations, having the patient tell the story is very useful. In other situations, having the patient tell the story can actually be a distraction. Right? So what's important is to help people become discourse analysts, to help people to be able to understand the different kinds of affordances and constraints of different kinds of genres of communication and different kinds of media of communication, and also to help people to be able to analyze the circumstances of communication and the relationship that is developing on a kind of ongoing basis with the person with whom they're communicating, and then make their decisions in a much more interactive way, in a much more sort of online way, rather than approaching the communicative situation with this kind of checklist of what they're supposed to say or what they're supposed to do.
Absolutely. I mean, anecdotally, I sort of feel as a patient, you get the impression that certain doctors are just very skilled communicators and are able, using one strategy or another, to make the interaction work. I guess it's quite difficult to train the particular skill set that you would argue is required, though, isn't it?
Well, I think it's certainly a much more difficult task than simply giving somebody a very kind of skills-based approach. But I do think that it's possible, and it is being designed and implemented in a number of different places. It's something that's is not totally unfamiliar to us, and interestingly enough, it's something that's not totally unfamiliar to applied linguists who are involved in language teaching. Right. So in quite a lot of language teaching materials, particularly kind of communicative based language teaching materials for advanced students, there's quite a lot of attention paid to helping students to learn various ways of assessing the situation, of approaching communication not as a set of skills, but as a set of strategies. I think that I think it's a bit more difficult, but I think it's something that's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm. You talk in chapter 7 about biomedicalization, this idea that with increasingly sophisticated technologies and so on, scannings were increasingly reducible to rather impersonal data, but these outputs, as you argue, are still subject to this process of discourse construction. So, does that mean, in some sense, it would be a mistake to think of them as being inherently more objective than, for example, narratives?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's actually a point that I make in Chapter 3 as well, that any form of contextualization is a perspective. It's a version of reality. So to express something as numbers or as big data, or to express it as a narrative, or to express it as a picture, no matter how you express it, you're favoring a particular version of reality. You're revealing some aspects of the reality, and you're concealing other aspects of the reality. And so this whole process of biomedicalization is something that fascinates me now, because on some level, you can see it as kind of very impersonal, as something that's reductive, as something that's transforming bodies and people into a set of data and numbers. But there is also another side of the story that I'm becoming fascinated with, and that is how people in social networks are actually interacting with this data. And so, you know, sort of Facebook style with this data. And so the data starts to take on this kind of more personal and even kind of hyper-personal dimension to it. And we see that apart from, you know, medical communication, we see that in all sorts of computer-mediated communication. We particularly see it on Facebook, where, you know, Facebook is this fascinating combination of hyper-personal communication and big data and algorithms. And then they're sort of mixing together in this very interesting way. But I think most of us are already, you know, at this point, very, very far from understanding. And so in my mind, this is, for applied linguists, this is, you know, one of the biggest challenges. Right? How do we, as applied linguists, start to understand the real core of communication in the 21st century, which is not necessarily the surface discourse, not necessarily the words that are being spoken or typed, but the algorithms, the programs, and the interfaces, all of these sort of new forms of discourse that most of us are, quite frankly, not really trained to understand. And so I think in the future, if you want to be a good discourse analyst, you should probably learn a bit about programming.
Indeed, yes. And in some sense, the book comes full circle, doesn't it? Because you end by talking about the role of communities and social networks in, as you say, interpreting this powered data, which brings you back to the original motivation, but from a slightly different perspective, the roles of communities and groups in shaping discourses around health.
Yes, I think that health is never an individual thing. It's not about individual decision making. Any decision you make about your health is made within the context of the social group or social groups with which you interact, and will obviously be affected by that. And so, even when we're alone, trying to sort of make the decision whether to eat an apple or eat a piece of pie, we can't escape the effect of our communities and our social worlds. And that's becoming even more prominent because we're becoming much more connected with our communities, much more connected, literally connected to these electronic means with our social networks. And what happens in our social networks always affects what happens with our health. I mean, social network research, even before the internet, found all sorts of interesting things about the effect of, you know, behavior within social networks on people's health. If people in your social network stop smoking, even if you do not know those people direct and have direct contact with these people, but these people are sort of friends of friends of friends, the chances of you quitting smoking suddenly become much higher. So there are ways that we affect each other. And so understanding, I think, for people interested in health and medicine and also for people interested in applied linguistics, understanding these connections, this web of connections that joins people together in very, very complex ways. I even feel that the word community is you know, not really the best word to describe the multiple ways that we are related to one another and the multiple ways those relationships affect the way we think, the way we communicate, and the way we construct our identities.
Our time here is nearly up. I should ask, given the, you know, huge multiplicity of very challenging tasks that you flag up as possible avenues for research, What are you working on now? What are your own priorities?
Right. Well, my biggest priority now is trying to understand something about health informatics. And so really I'm jumping off from that material in Chapter 7 where I talk about things like genetic testing, things like health social networks on the internet, things like self-quantification, So I'm very, very interested in how these new forms of communication are affecting how people communicate and behave around their health. And I'm very interested in working with doctors. And I've been talking to quite a number of doctors, working with doctors to help them to kind of make this transition to a world that I believe will be very, very different from the world that we're living in now, where people will be interacting less with their doctors and more with software, more with algorithms, helping them to make health decisions. And doctors will play a kind of facilitative role in this. And so I think this is something that that we can make a big contribution to.
Absolutely. Are you optimistic about the future of healthcare, given this possible contribution to advancing these processes?
That's a very complicated question. I mean, I think that advances in technologies have a lot of exciting things that can come about because of these advances in technologies around giving individuals and giving communities the tools to understand and take more responsibility for their health and for their behavior. And I think that's a very, very positive thing. But I think that there, at the same time, are a lot of dangers associated with this. One danger being the kind of consumerization of health. The more these kinds of capacities for people to take more responsibility for their own health develop, the more the state and institutions feel that they don't have to take responsibility. And so, you know, beyond these communication issues, there are larger kind of economic and political issues that I think that we need to address. And so I suppose I can say I'm neither optimistic or pessimistic. I'm wary.
Well, that sounds like an appropriate measure of caution on which to end. So let me say, Rodney Jones, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
I've been talking to Rodney Jones about health and risk communication. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language saying thank you for listening. Thank you.